Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Ambassador Jorge Alberto Lozoya, who's had a long and distinguished career as an internationalist and historian, active in many fields in public television, in the museum world. He's been in the diplomatic service in embassy to and consulate to Taiwan, Israel, Palestine, Malaysia, and Spain, UNESCO, among others, and has received decorations from many international governments, as well as being the author of numerous books and articles, including several volumes on the new international economic order, as well as on Mexican cinema, the Mexican army, and I also saw one on Ibero-American gastronomy, which I very much want to read. Ambassador Lozoya, thank you very much for being here.
Well, my pleasure. I'm very, very old, as you can tell from what Ben just wrote. I mean, read.
It's a distinguished career, most recently as the founding director of the International Museum of the Baroque in Puebla, Mexico. You gave a very interesting lecture on that museum and its creation. And I wanted to ask you about this term, the Baroque, which, as you described, is not only a certain kind of twisted pearl, a historical period in art history, but also a word that can be applied to contemporary culture. And I wondered whether in your sense of history, if certain aspects of contemporary culture can also be considered Baroque. Do you see the history as kind of going in some kind of cycle, perhaps?
Of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And this is the whole point.
Yeah.
In that sense, Western history, fortunately, yeah, is approaching Asian and African perspectives.
Yeah.
History comes back.
Okay.
Not the same.
Yeah.
But it's a system that is twisting itself.
Yeah.
Baroque, as you just said, is a Portuguese word defining the unperfect pearl. The idea that life is amorphous, twisted, disguises itself, mysterious, fantastic,
yeah,
unexpected. That is coming back, especially in the West, that for the last at least 200 years thought or hoped that history and life were rational, that you could plan, that things were going to be progressive,
yes,
progressive,
yeah,
in
yeah,
one line, that you could literally preconceive your future as a person, as a family, as a nation. It's not like that. And of course, the Chinese, the Indians, the Koreans, the Latin Americans know that. Unfortunately, it's now for the Dutch and for the French and for the Scandinavians to learn that.
Okay.
But Mexico had a wonderful experience during the Baroque period, which,
yeah,
is the 19th and 18th centuries. We were very lucky. We were a big power.
Yeah.
We handle very successfully the trans-Pacific trade of the Spanish Empire, which,
yeah,
was very good. Most people don't know that the Philippines were part of Mexico. Navigating from Acapulco in the Pacific coast of Mexico to Manila was a daily thing.
Yeah.
And it came out very well. And Puebla was the trade capital of New Spain, of Mexico. Mexico City, as of today, was the political center.
Yeah.
But Puebla was where the trade was handled. Therefore, the wealth coming from that enormously successful first globalization produced a very wealthy society that now wants to pay tribute to that period in the museum and at the same time learn for the future.
Yeah. That this galleon, which you discussed also in your talk, going in between Acapulco and Manila from those very early days, I was curious whether, I know this is sort of a big question, but between that first period and today, has the trade with Asia continued that whole time or sort of ebbed and flowed?
China is now our second trade partner of Mexico, second only to the USA.
Yeah.
I'm replying to your question.
Yeah.
And we are going back to Asia with our partners of the past,
yeah,
Peru, Chile, Ecuador, and Colombia. The Manila galleon came to Acapulco, and one third of the products went down the Pacific to Peru.
Yeah.
For 200 years. Now we are going back together. Yes. The answer is yes, and very positive.
So it, in between the kind of the contemporary time in the 1980s, 90s, and so forth, and going back to the 17th and 18th century, did that trade continued throughout that whole period?
No. We stopped with the independence in the 19th century. And I'm going to say it. One of the conditions that England imposed on our republic to recognize its independence in the early 19th century was that we stopped navigating in the Pacific.
Interesting.
Because they were expanding. There's a logic. The British were entering very successfully the Pacific. And our national heroes that consolidated the independence agreed. Yeah. So we suddenly stopped. All the 19th century and a good part of the 20th century, we did not travel regularly by sea to back to Asia. It's true.
Yeah. In terms of the in your experience, both diplomatic and cultural, I wanted to ask you also about, let's say, the cultural trade between Mexico and Asia, for instance. Would there be certain authors from Asia or artists from Asia who are especially renowned in Mexico?
No.
Or the other way?
No.
So it's less
not
familiar.
Yet.
Not yet.
At the same time, and entre nous, and we are intellectually concerned with these matters, individual artists, including literature, are a Western phenomenon.
Can you explain what you mean?
Well, they are, to a great extent, the very positive and creative product of Western civilization. For instance, in painting, the Chinese insist very much on that today. The idea of you becoming a superstar, a painter, a famous painter, is not Chinese.
Interesting.
Historically. Yeah. For instance, I don't know if you are aware of that, but Chinese artists, landscapers, never painted in the countryside or at the seashore. They would go sit there, look at whatever they were experiencing, and then they would go and draw at their studio. The idea of sitting there and use your paintings, no, that's not it. And the role of literature is also a Western European phenomenon that, of course, became an eclosion in the 19th century. So the Asians, of course, they learned from that, copied that. But now they're going back to their own way of perceiving the arts, which is something that we in this part of the world, in America, should learn more about. Yeah. And please allow me to congratulate you, Ben, personally, for the fantastic production of the Athenaeum Review.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I think that you personally are doing an extraordinary effort. I read the first issue of the magazine, of the review, with enormous interest and great admiration, because the work of putting together the thinking of very important experts on things that they are not experts on was fantastic.
Thank you.
I have experience as a journalist and editor, and I appreciate the enormous effort that you personally put into this. Congratulations.
Thank you. That is very kind, and I hope that we can continue. I appreciate it. With another question I had about the Baroque in this country, let's say if you take maybe one art history class, you might learn about the Baroque and one or two artists like Bernini or, you know, European artists.
Caravaggio.
Yes. But as you mentioned, the extremely rich Baroque culture in Puebla is really amazing. I wonder if you could just describe maybe something about the kind of Baroque style in Puebla that might be very unfamiliar to someone who only knows Bernini and Caravaggio.
Well, Puebla, like all central Mexico, was born with the first splendors of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church was a creation, really, of Spain and Portugal as empires. And the Spaniards themselves didn't really know what was all going to be about. They were experimenting. That's why Barroco is an experiment. It's not true that the Jesuits and the Franciscans and the Dominican priests knew what they were going to do. They were exploring, discovering, conquering. So they found in central Mexico extremely advanced civilizations that were very good at the arts and crafts. I'll give you an example. The Cathedral of Puebla, which is a magnificent Baroque and post-Baroque construction, was finally completed politically by a wonderful man who was a great bishop, Palafox. And he, in his memoirs, he wrote one weekend, "This is marvelous." They were finishing the building.
Yeah.
Said, "All these Mexican," he meant indigenous people, "all these Mexican workers are fantastic." And this morning, while I was supervising, he says, a very young man, completely naked, like an angel, was at the top of the tower. And from there, he shouted in his language, that is in Nahuatl, "Move, move away. Because if I fall, I will take you all with me to the paradise." I said, "I'm working with angels, naked and up there." I said, "Move yourself, because if I fall, I'll take you to paradise." This is wonderful. And it's true. Both the Aztecs, the Chichimecas, the Cholultecas, all the people of the central of Mexico were extraordinary builders, painters, sculptors. So there was a matching. And this is important. The Spanish missionaries that came to Mexico in the late 16th, beginning 17th century, many of them were coming from India and from China and from what we now call Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Cambodia. So they had seen also the extremely, we would say, Baroque architecture and sculptures of India, of Malaysia, of Indonesia. So when they arrived to America and found people who, by the way, Mexican indigenous people, look very Southeast Asian. You see a Mexican Indian and he looks from Malaysia or from Indonesia. Yeah. So they matched the idea, saying, okay, these people, as the great civilizations, non-Christian of Asia, know how to sculpt flowers, angels, Baroque.
Yes.
We got to a point that the super Baroque design of Puebla's churches and palaces was called Churriguera, which was a Basque Spanish architect. Churriguera, the top of twisted and all that. We're very proud of that, and it's very legitimate. It's extremely complex. And if you are not a Catholic and you're a Westerner, sometimes you find it difficult to understand. People who come from a Northern European
Protestant
faith are used to empty churches when saints were removed. Exactly. So suddenly you come to this full of gold and color temple, said, "Oh my God, can you concentrate here?"
Right.
And we do, but Protestant scholars usually have a problem because they have a much more austere approach to praying and to connecting with God.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I mean, even here here in Dallas, which is fairly global, of course there are Catholic churches, but there also is a particular, well, actually there are several, but I've been to one or two actually Hindu temples. What you describe, it's so similar. It reminds me of what you said a moment ago about the Baroque elsewhere, that it seems that both the Hindu and Catholic aesthetic with this proliferation is quite
It's not a coincidence. It matched. It was happening. The Catholic Church was beginning to become universal. That's what the meaning of Catholic is, as you know. So they traveled all over Asia. Yeah. And you can imagine if you were born in France and you arrive and see elephants that are gods in Calcutta. And then you come to our part of America and you also find animals being gods. So the melange is very creative, and we're very proud of this Baroque identity of Central Mexico and especially Puebla. Yes.
Amazing. Well, I also wanted to ask about a little bit about your own background. And I found one article actually in which, or I believe you described taking a bus trip all the way across the United States to the United Nations and visiting the United Nations and being struck by
it. Was my 15th birthday.
15. Okay. And where were you coming from?
Mexico
City, all the way to
by bus. Alone.
For school.
No,
just to...
my birthday is in December.
Yeah.
And I was always a good student.
Yeah.
And when I was going to turn 15, that in Mexico is a very symbolic age, I asked my father, would I go to New York? I had never been. Yeah. And he said, well, if you get the proper prices, which I knew I was going to, you'll go. And I won. So I went to, my father said, okay, give me my plane ticket. Yeah. And who else is going with me? Are you coming? He said, no. Yeah. First of all, you are going alone. Oh, and you are going by bus. I said, excuse me, yes. Yeah. And I'm going to give you money. And that's it. No traveler's checks at the time. Yeah. Needless to say, credit cards. Yeah. God bless you. I'm back. The only thing I want is a postcard from you from New York City. And I did. Yeah. I traveled by Greyhound the entire country, and I landed in New York City for my birthday, which I spent drinking 3 beers, talking to the marble lions at the entrance of New York's public library. That was like that. And the next day, the day of my birthday, I went to the UN headquarters, and I loved it. And I entered, like many other tourists, to see one of the main halls with the diplomats working there. Yeah. So at the end of the tour, led by a Spanish lady, of course it was in Spanish, the group, I asked her, what is it, what can I do to work here? And everybody laughed. And she said, the tour is finished, go. You young man, come here. What was your question? I would like to work here. What should I study? And she said, international relations, and you have to speak Spanish, English, Russian, and Chinese. So I said, thank you. Many, many years later, I chaired an international meeting in that same hall. And when I was listening, you know, to the distinguished delegates, I suddenly turned my sight and I saw the tourists watching from the top. Yeah. And I was extremely moved because it was the realization of my dream. I made it. But I worked very consistently on this, and I must say I had the absolute, total support of my parents, both my father, who was a very distinguished physician, and my mother, who was a wonderful nurse. And they supported all my crazy dreams. And by the age of 17, I was already studying in Russia. And then I studied Chinese at Stanford University. I've been a blessed person, very lucky.
It's a remarkable story. Did you already see, you studied in Moscow?
Yes. Well?
Yes, and so you got the Russian and the Chinese.
Yes.
When you were, and I know doing, as you mentioned, doing advanced study, so you were, from that age, you were already determined to be a diplomat from
yes,
that
sir.
Age. So you had
yes, sir. And I learned that knowing others is extremely difficult, and that you have to be trained systematically to understand other civilizations, other races, other languages. But it's for good, but it's not easy. So if you are having trouble understanding the global world, it's normal.
Right, yeah.
And it's going to get more complicated.
Yes.
Because everybody has rights and positions. Yeah. And with the instant communication of today, everybody expresses his or her points of view.
Yeah.
So it's fun.
Yeah.
It's democratic and it's fun, but it's very difficult. So we need more diplomats, more people in international relations, but who are prepared to build something. It's not just sympathy. It takes a lot of training. Like in this university, like Richard Brutel, like you yourself, working with the alien nature of communication among cultures and disciplines.
That reminds me, with this question of globalization, I'm sure especially now, it seems very, at least in this country, very frequently, and in other countries too, you know, it's clear that many people see globalization as a kind of threat, saying, you know, I don't want my job to go to another country. I'm afraid. People are afraid. I say they're worried that
globalization. You have to be afraid of being afraid.
Yes. Okay. So that's what you would...
Absolutely.
What would you tell someone?
Things are going to get more complicated.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid. You will defeat yourself by being afraid.
What about, correct me if I'm wrong, I know that in many, especially perhaps during the Cold War, with the United States policies in the Cold War, and I believe in Mexico and in many countries, there were also many people who would say, this is just, Yankee imperialism. The United States wants to spread it's Coca-Cola and McDonald's everywhere. And, you know, we're afraid that if we open up to the superpower, that the United States is just going to dominate us. And so
what's your doubt? What's your question?
Oh, my question is,
or your concern,
what you would say to someone, if someone in a smaller country, I mean, I know you said, watch out for being afraid. You said, my question is to someone in a smaller country who says, well, I'm afraid that if we accommodate globalization, that the superpowers like the United States and China will just dominate our country and our culture. What do you say?
That's nonsense.
Yes.
North America is today Canada, the United States of America, and Mexico. We have succeeded in integrating our trade and our economies. We are now North Americans and Latin Americans at the same time.
Yeah.
Just think of the size of our economy from Alaska to Cancun. And if you come from small European country, just the size of Mexico, and we're the smallest of the three countries of Canada, the US, and Mexico. The size of Mexico, the distance between Tijuana in Baja California and Cancun in the Yucatan Peninsula is the equivalent to the distance between Lisbon in Portugal and Warsaw in Poland.
Yeah.
That's just Mexico. So think of the economies and the trade of the three of us together.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
It's hard.
We're a superpower.
Yeah.
Do you know the volume of legal trade between Mexico and US?
I don't.
$1 million per minute.
It's amazing.
$1 million per minute.
Yeah.
The legal.
And much of it comes through here in Texas.
Yeah. Well, incredibly big.
Yeah.
And by the way, China is now the second trade partner of Mexico.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is that global interaction, which is not the first time that it happened, it happened in the Baroque period.
Yeah.
Can you imagine when men and women discovered that you could navigate a round planet? Damn it! Wasn't that fantastic?
Yeah.
And they didn't know that that planet, that sphere, was moving. Now we know that it's moving very fast, right?
Yeah.
But we can go from north to south, and now we fly. By the way, people learn flying in the Baroque, the balloons. The balloon was the first flying machine, and it's the Baroque period. So this global communication, action, trade, universities, everything, even crime is global.
Yeah.
Has nothing against national interests. It's too categories. The nations of the 21st century are going to be global. They already are.
Yeah.
Take Netflix. We in Mexico now, in my small town, well, my small, beautiful city, we see the best, newest American films the same day that they are presented in Hollywood.
And people here can watch Roma.
Of course.
For example.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And we buy in the same malls, in the sense that we know that vegetables are here and the cheese is there and all that.
Yeah.
On the entire planet. I remember when the first Russians that traveled to the Western Hemisphere after the end of the Soviet Union were absolutely astonished by Mexican supermarkets. One famous young philosopher, he cried in a Mexico City supermarket.
Yeah.
He said, my God, what is this? Well, it's free trade. That's why then Gorbachev said that the big failure of the Soviet Union was that there was not soap to wash yourself. But Mexicans, since the very beginning of times, we bathe with Colgate Palmolive. We call it Colgate Palmolive. But it's Colgate Palmolive.
Yeah.
And we have always driven Fords, Chryslers. There's no Quetzalcoatl. You see what I mean?
Right.
Global dreams of sharing are growing.
Yeah.
Please go to Shanghai. Go to the malls in Shanghai. And now in Moscow. The malls in Moscow, my dear friends. Please go. The same trades of Europe and of America that you enjoy in Amsterdam or in Paris. When the Soviet Union feared that the Russians were going to invade Western Europe, they were going to move as illegal immigrants. They didn't.
Yeah.
They, of course, went shopping,
Went
to Paris, and then went back to Russia.
Yeah.
The Russians are in Russia. Yeah. Please go to Siberia.
Yeah.
Siberia is nothing to do with Dr. Zhivago. It's a fantastic, like Texas. So fear is an invention of people who are not properly trained to understand the alien side of civilization.
Yeah.
That's why we diplomats and military experts and religious authorities in the world have to do. When a Mexican goes to... I'll give you a story of a famous Hungarian young, like you, historian who came to visit Puebla not long ago. And I took him to the cathedral. We've been talking about the cathedral on a Sunday. It happened to be Sunday morning, and I took him, and he saw the cathedral full of people coming out from Mass, and he started crying. He asked me, can I sit down? I said, yes. I know that Hungarians are Catholic. And he sat and said, I can't believe this. In this beautiful, rich city of today, everybody's coming to Mass. I said, yes, what's the problem? And he said something incredible. He said, in Europe, people don't go to church anymore.
Yeah.
Can I call my wife? Because I have to tell her.
Yeah.
Crying. Isn't that quite shocking? And of course, Mexicans were coming out from church laughing.
Yeah.
And as usual. You see, the two largest Catholic countries in the world today are Brazil and Mexico. And the Pope is Argentinian.
Yes, yes, yes.
So it's out. It's the time of Latin America in the Catholic Church.
It is, yeah.
So all these things are not to be afraid of.
Yeah, yeah. It's an amazing... That's quite a story.
I was in Paris with a very important group of intellectuals telling them this part of the consolidation of Latin American presence in the Catholic Church. And a young philosopher, very French, who was listening to me at the table, it was a dinner table, was very serious. And I asked him, how do you react to what I just said about the very big presence of Latin American countries in the Catholic Church? And you know what he said? Well, it shows the decadence of the Catholic Church.
What does that mean?
You can imagine my reaction.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say it here. At the end, he had to apologize. And he said, you are completely... nuts.
Yeah.
It's a new era. Is it dangerous that the Pope is an Argentinian? Huh?
Yeah.
That Brazilians and Mexicans are running Rome? The Vatican, is that bad? Why? Etc., etc., etc. The same is happening with Islam. The Jewish identity is stronger than ever. I was ambassador, as you said, both to Palestine and to Israel.
Yeah.
And the Chinese, who don't have a religion, Confucianism is not a religion, it's not even a philosophy. The word philosophy is Western.
Right, right.
They simply enjoy this. By the way, Confucianism is back. It's an extremely interesting phenomenon. Millions and millions of copies of books and TV shows are being produced on the revival and the rethinking of Confucian thought in China. It's very interesting.
You know, that reminds me of something else you mentioned in your lecture, which I thought was very inspiring, talking about the children or the youth orchestra from the local community. And I think you said something in Puebla, something to the effect that, you know, Beethoven is ours, Shakespeare is ours, all of these great artists and creators, it's not only for Germans to listen to Bach or whatever, it's this inheritance that can be shared across these nations. And this image of these children brilliantly playing this music, I thought was so inspiring. But I wanted to ask, you know, some people will say, well, you know, instead of, we shouldn't be studying all of these dead white males, you know, don't study Beethoven, you know, only we should study something that only belongs to us. I mean, do you encounter these kinds of questions?
Of course, and I laugh.
Yeah.
You know how many children in China are taking private classes of Western piano? How many Chinese children are taking today private lessons of Western piano? No? 35 million. So relax.
Those families aren't concerned that this music isn't Chinese.
Of course,
they don't see it as
it's worldwide.
Yeah.
Not only soap and cars and airplanes and Coca-Cola. Good for them.
Yeah.
Culture is also universal. And for Americans, I mean, you and I, as citizens of the Western Hemisphere, it's absolutely essential for us. You and I, we have been playing a violin or Mozart since we were children, and we read Cervantes and Shakespeare? Yeah. Yes or no? And Molière? What do you mean? What do you mean? That's European.
Yeah.
And you speak English and I speak Spanish, which are European languages.
Yeah.
I don't speak Nahuatl.
Yeah.
Do you speak Navajo?
No. And I don't see it.
So we are Mexicans. We make fun of that. When we go to Paris, the French used to, at the past, look for our feathers. Say, okay, you're a Mexican. Are you an Aztec? No. This is the way. That's why Americans, by Americans now, I mean the whole Western Hemisphere, were global from the very beginning. And for Mexicans today, even from modest, very modest origins, they play Beethoven, they read classics. Well, but it's not new. After the Mexican Revolution in 1919, when Mexico was extremely poor, very poor, a wonderful minister of education, José Vasconcelos, printed for the first time in Mexico all the classics, Plato, Aristoteles, Shakespeare, by the millions. Yeah. And of course, where people say, we're so poor and you are wasting money in printing and giving away for 10 cents. And he said, Plato, Socrates are Mexican. Okay?
Yeah.
And our great artists, the Mexican Revolution of 1910 was the first revolution of the 20th century that not only did not eject their artists and intellectuals, but brought them back.
Yes.
Diego Rivera, Siqueiros, they were in Europe. And the revolution brought them. And they were communists, by the way. Members of the Communist Party.
It's amazing.
That's globalization.
Yeah.
In 1920, the leading Mexican painters were brought from Paris by the government and were members of the Communist Party for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
Frida Kahlo, now so popular, was homaged at her death at the National Palace of Fine Arts.
Yeah.
Her coffin wrapped in the communist flag in Mexico in the 1940s, 50s. This is globalization for us, for you as Americans and we as Mexicans or Argentinians.
Yeah, it's amazing those artists. I'm very interested in that story of the muralists and so forth. I just had it also reminds me. I know there are many, but one particular contemporary artist, Gabriel Orozco. Mm-hmm. Who, you know, I find him so interesting.
Fantastic.
He works, you know, he's all around the world. I feel like when I look at his work, I learn something about Mexico and Mexican culture, and also something about London, Paris, New York, and as well as, of course, his own mind. This kind of comfort and fluency across, it's quite remarkable.
Of course. Yeah. And the marvelous, I just referred to that in one of my lectures here, the fantastic dialogue between Octavio Paz, the great Mexican poet, and Suzuki, one of the masters of Zen Buddhism, 40 years ago, trying to communicate very successfully. Can you imagine Mexicans discussing Zen Buddhism? Yes, and not yesterday, before Google. So we in the Western world are discoverers, all of us. Descubridores. We're all conquistadores. We came from ancestors who were traveling, men and women. Women are very important on this. Today, it's culture and education in all the Western Hemisphere is mainly in the hands of women. Let's be prepared for that. Government, too, is moving that way. Yeah. But educational culture is, and health, an enormous female presence, which is good. And welcome.
Yeah.
But is that no? Well, yes and no. The most famous, most important, and famous at the time, poet of the Spanish language of the Baroque period was a Mexican nun, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. Mexican and nun. And is the most famous poet of the Spanish language of the Baroque period. She, her cell in the convent was two stories high. He had a kitchen. She had maids, and she organized all the parties, literary parties and concerts, at the Palace of the Viceroy.
Wow, it's amazing.
Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz.
Yes.
Great poet.
That reminds me, I wanted to ask, for those of us in the United States who may want to learn more about the history and culture of Mexico, I know there was one author a number of years ago who, there were these several books by Jorge Castañeda.
Yes,
all about, you know.
He's still there.
Oh, yeah.
Very active.
But he's been writing for many years. I was curious if you could recommend, if there's one or two or a few books you would say, here, if you're in the United States and you want to read something to understand a little bit better about Mexico, if there's some book.
Read Jorge Castañeda, read Héctor Aguilar Camín. Jorge Castañeda and Héctor Aguilar Camín, like 3 years ago or four, traveled together, all Mexico, the entire country, talking to middle-class people. And they came out with a fantastic result. They would be greeted. They are famous people. And they have a good lunch, as Mexicans we eat all the time and drink. So tell us how you feel Mexico is a disaster. Oh, terrible. Politics are very bad. Oh. And your personal life? I've been very lucky.
Yeah, yeah.
My wife is doing fine.
Yeah.
My girl is already at the university.
Yeah.
My job, my business is very good. But they, from that final decision, politics are hell. But fortunately, my family is doing fine, or my city, or my company. It's very interesting. It's a contradiction in the attitude of the people more than in the reality. And they published a lot of articles on that. Now we have, for instance, a government of the left. President López Obrador was elected by the largest majority in the history of Mexican democracy.
Yeah.
Good for him. And he appears every morning on the mass media at 7 o'clock in the morning from the first day of his government, including Sundays. And he answers all questions. You see? So, and some of the questions, especially at the beginning, were terrible. And he asked them all, said, I don't know, let me find out. Or, yes, you are right, things are bad, things are... And he's a man who has been in politics for his entire life.
Yeah.
And now he's the president.
Yeah.
And this is important for Americans to understand, that now we have a progressive leftist government, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Nothing to be afraid of.
So finally, I wanted to ask you also, I know you've been accomplished so many things, so many projects.
I'm old.
but if you wondered, looking to the future, your future projects that you may be planning for the upcoming years, if you have anything.
The coming years, hopefully, are going to be very few. We have to learn, and we're not taught this at school, to become old. I mean, Western civilizations. They never tell you, not even at the university, that you're going to be old. I have just retired. I have been retired for 6 months from all my professional activities.
Yeah.
I should be playing golf, but I don't play golf.
Oh, what will you do if you don't play golf?
That's a good question. I'm in Texas. But it's the... Why? Because I am 75 years old.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
you've earned a rest.
Still alive. But my next occupation is death. I'm prepared for it.
Yeah.
And I come from very old and distinguished civilizational roots of the Catholic Church and of Spain, you see. When I was young, as you are, and I'm a historian, so I would read history and say, why do kings retire to monasteries when they're old? Why do queens used to leave all their power and go to Jerusalem? Now I understand why. You have to prepare yourself for that transit.
Yes, yes.
You see? And it's a complex matter. It has to do with your daily routine. We were trained to work, to labor as much as possible. Yes, yes, more work. Okay. I know I was one of the, I belong into the generation of the flower power and all this, and the hippies. Okay, I have to go back to that.
Yeah.
Said, okay, what is the attitude? And of course, the closest references I find are in Asia.
Yeah.
The Chinese, the Indians from India, have a great concern for this.
Yeah.
The Chinese have always been very interested in old age.
Yeah.
Huh? And what you do when you are old. In terms of labor, I was extremely happy to let the young people I trained to take over. It was extraordinarily grateful for me. Because fortunately, I have trained many, many good professionals. I've been a professor all my life. So when I retired, I felt, I'm leaving this in good hands. And it's true. So this is what I do now. And I hope it doesn't last too long. I don't want to be ill and healthy. I don't want to be half dead in a hospital. Yet, surviving just for the fact of wearing kidneys from somebody else.
Not a kidney.
So that is my task. And that's why receiving the undeserved award of the Rick Britell recognition has been and is going to be for me a grandiose finale. And I thank you for being interested in what I do.
On behalf of UT Dallas, we are enormously grateful to you. Ambassador Jorge Alberto Lozoya has been our guest today on the Athenaeum Review podcast. Thank you for speaking with me.
My pleasure.